I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of the jazz drummer whose reputation was rescued by a recording. In his time, Ron Free was one of the best, a highly talented young drummer from South Carolina who found himself in the middle of the New York jazz scene when he was all of 19 years old. He wanted to learn. He was hanging out with the drummer Shadow Wilson, and he learned it all.
He says, well, come on downstairs. And whipped out this little package of white powder, took out a matchbook, scooped up a little bit on the tip of the matchbook, and held it out to me. I didn't even know what I was supposed to do with it. And I said, no, you go ahead.
The heroin pretty well ended Ron Free's career, and that might have been the end of it if it hadn't been for another man poking through some old archives. Years later, the original recordings of Ron Free's drumming were rescued, and that's why you're hearing his story today. It's coming up right after the news. This is a story about one of the most highly regarded drummers you've likely never heard of. His name is Ron Free. Back in the jazz heydays of the late 50s, he was one of those sought after by the biggest bands. But Ron Free went too far, too fast, and found himself snorting heroin with one of the musicians he looked up to.
I was young and impressionable and wanting to do what the big boys were doing. So it went from snorting to what we call skin popping to eventually mainlining.
Ron Free disappeared from sight almost as quickly as he rose to the heights of jazz drumming. A jazz archivist found some old recordings and then found Ron. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The stories of high-flying musicians who wind up using drugs to maintain their altitude and airspeed are legion. Some make it through, some don't. This is the story of one who did. We're listening to the drumming now of a man who found his own high perch in the smoky jazz lofts of New York City back in the late 50s. His unusual skill as a drummer got him there, and his addiction to drugs ended his time there pretty quickly. Ron Free's now 72 years old, and he's still drumming. He's here to reflect with us on how he made it through and how that music survived. Ron recently wrote a poem about how it all started, recalling his own childhood perspective of a parade in Charleston, South Carolina.
The crowd, the clowns, the straining to see over shoulders of people much taller than me, when suddenly in the distance I hear the sound of the drums drawing near. Then add a few trumpets and other brass horns, the floats, the horses, the pink unicorns. I'm 6 years old and do not expect to feel hair standing up on the back of my neck. Louder and louder the sound of the drums as something wondrous this way comes. Along with the drums my heart is beating. Over and over the cadence repeating parum-ta-tum-tum. Parum-ta-tum-tum, how compelling, how thrilling, the sound of the drum. Goosebumps crawling all over my skin, street beats repeating again and again. I push through to the front so that I might see this wonder of wonders, so inspiring to me. Girls with batons flying high in the air. Other little children are standing near, all looking and listening to the music coming. The sound of the brass and the drummers drumming. Many years have passed since that day. My eye has grown dim, my hair turned gray. Yet how vividly I still can recall the sight, sound, taste, and scent of it all. And to this day there's been no greater joy than the sound of the drum to that one small boy.
It must have been such a powerful experience for you to hear the drum at that age, for it to stand out still for you as such a strong memory.
Yeah, it made me want to stand tall and salute somebody or something. You know, it instilled the feeling in me that anything is possible. I guess it was shortly after that I got a little toy drum for Christmas. And so I strapped that on and marched around the neighborhood, you know, imitating those street beats that I'd heard, and And people would be walking by and say, oh, look at the little drummer boy. Play those drums. Brump the dum dum, you know. And I thought, well, shoot, this is all right. So,
when did you begin to think that it was more than just like a child's toy, something that you could make music on?
My father was an avid music fan, and he had a lot of old 78 RPMs, and I used to listen to things like jazz at the Philharmonics with Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich doing drum battles and things like that. And I remember one time Gene Krupa's band came through town. Of course, he was my first idol, I guess. Somehow or other, my father arranged to meet him and introduced me. Said, Gene, this is my boy, Ronnie. And Gene Krupa said, hi, Ronnie, would you like to sit in with the band? I almost soiled myself, but I did sit in with the band, and I guess I did all right. I don't know. The crowd gathered around and got standing ovations, you know, so that was quite thrilling for, I guess I was about 12 by then.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking with Ron Free, who rose to and then fell from a great height in his career as a jazz drummer. Even at that early age, Ron was good. He started gigging. He kept practicing at home.
I had several Gene Krupa records. I could play his licks, you know, had his little solos and things memorized. Sure. Sing, Sing, Sing was his biggie of the day.
Can you show us a little bit now what that was?
Horns come in and I guess that was relatively close. Close enough for jazz, as they say.
So you're 12 years old and you're starting to play with the local bands, and where are your parents with this, Ron? Are they thinking, no, this is enough of this, time to concentrate on school, or how are they guiding you at this point?
They were behind me. My father, he used to sit down behind my drums that I had set up in the living room, and he would fool around with them, and he was talented.
But he was hard on you, too. I read that somewhere.
Oh, yeah. He was a tyrant. He was an alcoholic, for one thing. And he had a very violent temper, and he yelled and screamed foul language for all the neighbors to hear. Sometimes it was embarrassing to go outside the house. But he loved me, and he wanted me to do well, I guess, in spite of all that. And he made me practice, actually, because I was scared to death of him.
Did he ever encourage you, though? Did he ever say, Ronnie, I like what you're doing there. Let's work more on that. Was there the support there, or was
it
more?
Don't remember much of that. It was always very critical. It was like a bottomless pit trying to please him. Nothing I did ever was good enough, you know. But he let me quit school when I was 16, and
in order to go out on the road,
went on the road. Yeah.
Which was the first band you went out with?
Tommy Weeks and his Merry Madcaps.
Now, I have to confess, I don't know the name of that band.
You've never heard of that band, my word. They came through town, and Daddy took me, and they did record pantomimes and skits and dirty jokes. And Tommy Weeks was a very sorry trumpet player by his own admission, but he was a pretty good comedian. Anyhow, he had them rolling in the aisle. And so that kind of became my second love. Because, you know, the whole drumming thing, that brought me attention and appreciation that I was starved for, I guess, from my father, and I just never could quite pull that off. And so to have all these people laughing, and that's almost as good as drumming, you know. So I sat in a couple of times when I was 13 or 14, probably, and he kept track of me, evidently, because he called me shortly after my 16th birthday. And asked me if I would like to go on the road. And, of course, you know, I was thrilled.
That was a dream come true, I bet.
Yeah, really.
That first job, when Ron Free was 16, paid him $90 a week. But life on the road with Tommy Weeks and his merry madcaps didn't turn out that well. The beginning of sorrows, as Ron recalls. Tommy turned out to be an alcoholic and a gambler who'd blow everyone's salary at the racetrack. Ron recalls one night when they had to stop and redeem soda bottles to get enough gas to make it to the next gig. But he stuck with it until he heard about an opening for a drummer with a girly show in a traveling carnival.
Girly show, that sounded pretty good. And I got to do a little drum solo at the beginning of every show. So I was like a pop star there for a while. The little teenagers would come in for the matinees and the girls would be screeching, you know, for me when I would do my drum solos. I'd signing autographs, you know, so I thought, shoot, this is all right.
What was a girly show in the early 50s, a traveling girly show? I mean, was it part of a circus or a fair? Or?
It was Royal American Shows, world's largest midway. We did mostly state fairs. Pretty tame stuff by today's standard. But I had a stateroom on the train, and we used to play poker during the trips in the dining car. And it was kind of like the scene, are you familiar with the Star Wars bar scene?
All those crazy
all
creatures.
All those freaky, you know, all those aliens. It was kind of like that in the dining car. You know, we had the Viking giant and the bearded lady and the midgets and me. You know, I felt right at home. So.
You'd be the Luke Skywalker. The what am I doing here?
Yeah.
What was your dream at that time, though? Were you thinking, I've got a job, I'm set for life, or I want to be playing with some of the bigger bands that I'm hearing on the records? What were you dreaming?
Yeah, big bands, I guess, was my first calling. I saw Woody Herman while I was out with Tommy Weeks. I remember the day that I went and saw him, and I put that on my list. You know, I want to play with this band someday. And in Miami, around the corner from where we were working, Lena Horne was appearing in a club there. And I used to go around there, and I would just get glimpses in when somebody would open the door, and I could see her under the spotlight, and I could see, you know, they were.
You couldn't go in. You weren't old enough, right?
Right. But, yeah, I would stand out, and I would listen, and, boy, the music sounded so good. And so I kind of put that on my list.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me.
And be careful what you ask for, because a lot of those things that I put on my list early on eventually came to pass.
Maybe too early on.
Well, actually, yes.
We're drinking, my friend.
Ron Free was invited to play with Lena Horne and Woody Herman, but along with the fame came the expectations and the pressure and the nerves and eventually a reliance on drugs. More on that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Some things never change. Athletes and actors and musicians continue to commit their celebrity stumbles when they wind up relying on drugs. Today I'm talking with a man whose tumble occurred almost 45 years ago. Ron Free was a top jazz drummer who now looks back at his fall with perspective. Ron landed in New York smack in the middle of the golden age of jazz. He was 18. At first he stayed with relatives on Staten Island, but one night he got a cheap room in the city on the second floor of a midtown hotel.
I could look out my window and I could see Broadway, you know. And, you know, I'd seen so many movies and pictures and heard so many stories and read so many books and things about the Great White Way. And it was really exciting to be there. I don't think I slept very well that night.
What did you think at that time, Ron? Did you think that you were there or halfway there? What did you think?
Yeah, well, here I am, you know. Here I am, world. And so it was a whole mixture of things. I was totally intimidated by all those big buildings and all. I wandered around, you know, like a yokel that I was there for the longest kind of time. I went primarily so that I could be where the masters were and I could kind of worship at their feet, so to speak. You know, I could go to places like Birdland and and hear all these great jazz players, and started taking lessons with a guy named Mo Goldenberg, who was staff percussionist at NBC. And when I got my union card, Mo arranged for me to audition for an off-Broadway show that was starting up, a musical called Shoestring Review. And I got that gig. It was just, the pit band was two pianos and drums. And it ran for about 6 months or so.
Good money?
It was A scale, I think.
Good enough, then?
Yeah. I worked all the best clubs in New York, and the money wasn't that different from the little slimy clubs I worked back in Charles. And actually, some of those slimy clubs were more glamorous than some of those famous New York clubs. But there were a couple of dance numbers in the show that just had drums accompaniment. I remember one of the dancers would come out on the stage, oh, a drummer. And so I'd start playing, and then we'd go through a whole thing. So opening night, or the day before opening night, I guess, I went into a place called Charlie's Bar. A lot of musicians used to hang out in there, a lot of famous ones, people that I'd read about in Downbeat and Metronome magazines. So I gave out a bunch of tickets, free passes, for the opening, and one person that showed up was Oscar Pettiford. He was the preeminent bass player of that day. And he came to the show. And the very next day, he called me for a record date. Called me the next day for another record date. And eventually,
you were, what, 18 at the time, if that?
Yeah, I might have been 19 by then. I think I was 18 when I first hit the scene, but it was...
This was also a time when a lot of jazz musicians were gathering and playing in the lofts in New York, too, right?
Yes.
Tell me about the geography of these lofts. I mean, they have a kind of legendary place in American jazz history, but what did you see when you walked in? What went on in there?
The first one, it was very dark, and it was on the second floor up over a little delicatessen, and most of the lofts were located in business districts, so there were no people to bother at night, you know, if you jammed. Of course, they usually boarded up the windows and all anyhow and padded the walls. And so that first loft, it was just one big room, and there were a couple of guys living there, but they hung a curtain between in the middle of the room to separate the bedroom from the playing area. And most of them had an old beat-up upright piano that they tried to keep fairly well-tuned. And you just never knew who was going to show up at those things.
Now, if you went to one of those places, Ron, did you have to bring your own drums? How did that work?
No, there's usually somebody that leaves a set of drums there, you know, some drummer, some unemployed drummer. And there were a lot of those around. A lot of times, you know, I would leave my drums there between gigs. So.
And how long would you play?
Long time, because it depends on the situation. Some of them were relatively short, but every now and then you'd have this session where you'd have like 9 or 10 horn players and 3 or 4 drummers and piano players. And you know, you just take turns. And so it would go on for wee small hours. Sometimes you didn't even get started until the wee small hours.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. And what we're listening to now is a recording that was made in one of those jazz lofts back in the late 50s with Ron Free on the drums. In fact, it was the unexpected discovery of these recordings that was a part of the rediscovery of Ron Free. I'll get to that in just a moment. I asked Ron if he has the words to describe what it takes to be a really top drummer.
Drumming has always been kind of magical to me, so I guess that came through in my playing. I think being from the South is part of that, too, because, you know, there were a lot of great New Orleans drummers, for example. As a matter of fact, that first loft, it was peopled by a lot of Southerners. So my first recording that I didn't get through Oscar Pettiford was with Mose Allison, who I met in that first loft on East 34th Street. And Mose is from Mississippi. And I guess we kind of found a haven from all those Yankees out there.
Well, did you also get work from connections that you
absolutely
made at the loft.
Like I said, that first gig I did with Moe's, the record, he called me one day and said, Ronnie, I got a record date. Can you make a record date? And
I think I can do that.
I'll see what I can do. Moe's had a very distinctive style that was evocative of Mississippi. You know, he would write songs like Moon in Cypress. And
can you imitate that now? Can you give me a kind of a sense of what you're talking about in terms of how it worked for you as a drummer? Was it a pace that was a part of it?
It was a certain time feel, I guess. Moe's, all he had to do was just play a few bars on the piano, and I felt like playing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there was a chemistry between us. That's the magic of music, when you just meet somebody and sit down and play together, never played together before, and bang, it sounds like you've been playing together all your life, you know. So that's pretty magical stuff.
Ron Free then got what any performer might consider his one big break, a recommendation for the drummer spot with Woody Herman. Now, Woody Herman, you might recall, was one of the names on Ron's dream list.
My head was spinning. Things happened so fast, much to my amazement, you know, because I had no self-esteem. I knew I wasn't very good. I'm just from Charleston, and I'm just here to learn.
Oh, wait a second. Is that your father talking, or was that you?
Yeah, well, that was programmed into me, you know, because he was presented some strong arguments accompanied by feet to various body parts. But
Woody Herman, Ron, I mean, you couldn't get a better gig at that time.
Well, yeah, except that was the first big band I ever played with in my life. And there were certain things, you know, that you can only learn by experience, and I hadn't had that experience, so I was scared to death. And I had never really read drum charts before.
Is it sheet music? Is it the same as sheet music?
It's sheet music, yeah. But they don't write in everything. Plus, I probably couldn't have sight-read it if they had. So I'm back there with all those trumpets and trombones, and I've got this little rinky-dink set that I brought up from Charleston that was not suitable. You know, you need to be bold and big, and the drummer's in the driver's seat in a big band, you know, and that's and the trumpets come in.
You know, I hadn't thought about that you're not just one of the musicians in the band. You really are driving it.
Yeah. And it's just one of you, and there's five trumpet players and four trombone players and four or five saxophone players.
So how did it go? What was playing with Woody Herman like?
Well, the first night was fine. I guess I was relaxed because I figured too much wouldn't be expected of me the first night. And sure enough, all the guys were coming up and saying, wow, man, welcome to the band. You sound great, man. It sure is good to have a drummer that plays like that. And that just scared me even more. I felt like an imposter, you know. So I would have recurring nightmares. I would dream that I was playing with drumsticks the size of baseball bats, and the tempo was way up, ding, ding, ding. And I'm trying to keep up with the tempo, and I'm trying to keep up with the volume. And meanwhile, Woody Herman is standing in the front of the band saying, louder, louder. And I would wake up in a cold sweat. So I got fired eventually the night my parents came all the way from Charleston. I was playing in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, man, your parents did a long road trip to see you there.
Yeah.
What happened on stage that night?
Well, I didn't know the arrangements. And so I'm trying to read, and Woody would say, don't try to read it, just hear it. But the more you're there, the more you think, I should be learning these things now, and you miss a kick, and you think, oh, jeez, I missed another one, you know. And I didn't even know how to tune my drums. The cymbals I had were inadequate. He had to send somebody to buy me a set of hi-hats.
These are the little two that go together,
yeah.
Right?
With a big band, you know, you need a good so that they can know where two and four. Fear is a crippling disease, man. It you know, if when you're that scared, you're dysfunctional.
And it sounds like you were getting more and more frightened with each gig, right?
Yes.
So what happened in Cleveland?
We're playing the gig, and somewhere during the evening, he told me he had to let me go.
Would he tell you himself?
Yeah. He was kind of apologetic about it. He said, I've been this route before. I've hired a lot of young drummers that were inexperienced, and then they kind of hone their craft working with me, and then they leave and go with somebody else. I don't want to do that anymore. So I was devastated. To me, that was death. I went back to the band room and just bawled like a baby.
Huh.
Boo-hoo-hoo.
Anybody talk to you? Try to talk
to
you?
Yeah, five-man Vic Fellman. Bless his heart, he was just as nice as he could be. He came back and tried to comfort me. Look, man, you'd be all right. You've got the feel and everything. You just need some experience. That's okay. But I wouldn't have it. I wanted to die. I really did. I couldn't imagine recovering from that kind of devastation.
So back to New York after this. That's where you went?
Back to New York, back to the 34th Street Loft, and there was a trombonist named Clyde Cox, and he said, "What do you care, man? You shouldn't be out there with Woody Herman. Anyhow, you should be right here. You know, who gives a damn about Woody Herman's band, you know?" And so it kind of cheered me up, and I started getting calls. It's like, it really didn't matter. So that turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I went on to much greater achievements, and I learned that you can recover from anything.
Just when you came back then, that would have been when you played with Lena Horne, that would have been when you played with all the other greats of the day?
Yes.
Who else did you play with?
Stan Getz, Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, Bill Evans, but mostly combos. Made quite a few records with Moe's. You know, when you're in New York long enough, you play with damn near everybody if you've got anything going for yourself.
That, of course, is Ron Free on the drums there, playing with the Moe's Allison Trio in 1959. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. By now, Ron was treading that well-worn path of other musicians of his time. He was using heroin. In fact, it was worse. He was a junkie. Ron told me that the heroin started shortly after he'd arrived in New York, when he was introduced to one of his childhood idols, a drummer named Shadow Wilson.
And the first words out of his mouth was, "Ronnie, you get high?" And I thought he was talking about grass. And I said, "Sure, man. I'm hip." So he said, "Well, come on downstairs." And whipped out this little package of white powder, took out a matchbook, scooped up a little bit on the tip of the matchbook, and held it out to me. I didn't even know what I was supposed to do with it. And I said, "No, you go ahead." So that was my first experience. And I was young and impressionable and wanting to do what the big boys were doing. So it went from snorting to what we call skin popping to eventually mainlining.
This was heroin, not cocaine.
Heroin, yeah.
Did you get pretty strung out?
Well, not near as bad as many junkies that I've seen, but bad enough. But I was still ambitious enough, my career was still important enough to me to where I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I was starting to lose out on gigs because I started getting the reputation of being a junkie. And there was no way you can hide it. I used to wear sunglasses, but I've got blue eyes, and so heroin makes them pinpoint, and you can see from a
pupil gets too small.
Yeah, like people could see me coming from, a block away. So I got scared of destroying what little progress I'd made. Well, quite a bit of progress, actually, career-wise.
Yeah.
So I decided I was going to clean up my act. And it took some doing, but I eventually used cough syrup. You could go in a drugstore and buy cough syrup in those days. It had quite a bit of codeine in it. So that was...
Well, you must have had to drink a lot of cough syrup.
Yeah. But it took the edge off, and so eventually I was able to kick.
There's a photograph that we have of you. I think it's a 1958 photograph. And you're there with Mose Allison, Lester Young, Mary Lou Williams, Charlie Rouse, Oscar Pettiford. And you're wearing those dark glasses.
Yeah, looking cool, man.
Do you think the dark glasses were there to hide whatever was going on?
Probably so.
Yeah.
There is a more revealing story behind that day. Serious jazz fans know August 12, 1958. That was the day that Esquire magazine had 57 top jazz musicians pose for a group photo in front of a Harlem brownstone. Count Basie, Gene Krupa, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Mingus, they're all there. The photo's called A Great Day in Harlem. Ron Free was invited to join them, but he didn't make it. Ron admits that he didn't even remember that day until 40 years later when a friend sent him that other photo.
I open it and I pull out this picture. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a great picture, but I didn't even recognize myself in it.
You knew who the other musicians were and didn't know?
I knew everybody else, yeah, but I'm thinking, who is that guy? He looks kind of cool. But I knew who everybody else was, so that must be me on the corner there. It took a while, and then eventually I remembered, oh, yeah, that must be that day that we did that Esquire magazine thing in Harlem.
The photo Ron Free's talking about is just half a dozen musicians with Ron on the far left wearing those dark glasses. We have that picture on our website at thestory.org. But we're not ending Ron's story with him as a junkie, a former drummer. There is a rescue here. Both the man and his music are still with us, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Today I'm talking with the drummer, Ron Free, about his rise and fall in the jazz world. His story might never have been told if it hadn't been for the curiosity of one jazz fan. Sam Stevenson was busy cataloging a number of photographs in the archives at the University of Arizona when he made his own discovery.
And I noticed in the back of the photography archive there was a whole wall of cardboard boxes that were filled with reels of tape. And I asked the archivists, what were these audio tapes doing in there? And I was told, well, those are just these tapes that Eugene Smith made in his loft back in the 50s.
And nobody knew what was on them?
Well, the only clues were what Smith wrote on the labels. And so one time when I was out there in about 1998, I picked through all 1,740 reels of tape. And
that's a lot.
And I looked at each box, and I wrote down everything that Smith had written on the labels. And from that, I picked out 139 different names of musicians. And I was a jazz buff, so I was able to recognize some names. Now, there were a lot of names I didn't recognize.
And his labels tended to be what, Sam? They were just lists of names? Or would they say, you know, Sunday afternoon, 1960, blah, blah, blah? Or, I mean, how much detail did you have to work with?
There would be one tape that would just have, say, Monk on it, or Thelonious Monk, yeah. And that's all it would have. And then there were other labels that were quite well done that would have the list of six musicians, and then it would have an actual date. It would say February 23rd, 1959.
These tapes, is this where you first found the recordings of the drummer, Ronnie Free?
That's right. His name is all over the labels. He's one of the most ubiquitous names on the labels, if not probably the most commonly found name. He's all over the tapes.
Now, as you said, you're a jazz buff. Did you know of him beforehand?
I had heard his name because he's on a couple of well-known recordings, but I knew very little about him. So what happened is I took those 139 names that I got off the labels before I'd ever heard any of the tapes, and I started figuring out who these people are still alive. And two of the first people that I contacted were the bass player Steve Swallow and the piano player and vocalist Dave Frischberg. You know, I would just say, well, tell me about this loft. What do you remember about it? And both of them mentioned Ronnie Free in this kind of reverent terms. You know,
what did they say about him?
Well, I remember specifically Dave Frischberg had moved to New York to be a musician. And, you know, he was uncertain about whether he was going to be able to make it. Somehow he found his way to the loft one night, and Ronnie Free was in there playing drums, and Dave ended up on piano. And he said it was one of the most revelatory moments of his life, that here he was playing with this profound musician. He said it was that night he realized, this is what I want to do.
Did you think you were going to find Ron Free when you started?
I had no idea where he was. I mean, he, you know, people knew that he was a substance abuser at the time. And so, you know, a lot of those guys died early. So I wasn't sure I'd be able to find him.
Yeah, there wasn't much record of him after those jazz loft sessions back in the, what, late 50s, early 60s?
That's right. Ron basically left New York in the middle of the night and never went back. And so there were people in New York, musicians, who saw him every day who haven't seen him since.
Just thought he vaporized.
Right.
But Ron Free had not vaporized. He is still around, still drumming, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But back in the early 60s, Ron was in rough shape, still strung out. At the age of 23, he was into pills. He was about to hit bottom. He remembers when a policeman stopped him for jaywalking.
Might have saluted him or something. He thought I was a wise ass.
You probably were.
Which I probably was, yeah. But I didn't mean any harm, you know. I was just feeling good. So he decided, I'm going to run you in. Called the paddy wagon and hauled me down to the precinct. And I admitted I used drugs, and I don't remember whether I had any on me at the time, but I was probably popping some kind of pills. So we get down to the precinct, and he comes in. He says, look, I don't want to see you go to jail, but I could probably arrange for you to go to the hospital since you say you've used drugs. Which would you rather do, hospital, jail? Kind of a no-brainer at the time. So I said, shoot, hospital sounds pretty good. So the hospital turned out to be Bellevue, top floor of Bellevue. You know, the loony bin.
What did you think? Were you scared?
No, actually, I wasn't.
Here's the next question. Did you fit in?
I did, yeah. Plus, I knew that I was in good company. Charlie Parker had been through there, and Charlie Mingus, and a lot of many jazz.
Bellevue was like a stepping stone for like some of the jazz greats.
This is part of the path, you know. The funny thing is, when you're in a place like that, everything you say and do is suspect. And one day I was sitting in the rec room, and there was a Life or a Look magazine, I forget which, and it had Lena Horne on the cover with her son Teddy and her daughter Gail. Teddy was a very good friend of mine. We were about the same age when I was played with Lena. So here I am sitting in Bellevue, and I'm looking at this thing, and I'm reminiscing about, that was a sweet gig. A lot of status, you know. You were treated with respect, yeah. for once in my life, you know. So I'm sitting there, tears streaming down my cheek. So one of the attendants comes by and says, what's the matter with you, man? I pointed to the picture and I said, I'm just looking at my old boss here, you know. I used to work with Lena. And I might as well have said, I'm Napoleon or something, you know, because he said, yeah, okay. He patted me on the back.
You were in Bellevue. You
know? Yeah.
I think I can see his side of it at the same
well,
time.
Well, I understood.
How did you get out of there?
My parents came and... I was released into their custody.
That must have been kind of a low moment for you.
I think I was in pretty good spirits by then. For one thing, I'd kicked drugs.
You were in Bellevue?
Yeah. They were always trying to give me drugs, Thorazine or something, and I wouldn't have it. I would hide it under my tongue and pretend to take it and spit it out later, you know.
So you actually got clean while you were in Bellevue?
I got clean, yeah. But it didn't take me long to fix that when I got out.
Speed,
yeah. And speed kills. And I did more damage probably in a year's time than heroin had done in 2 or 3 years.
Were you taking a lot of pills?
By the time I quit, I was taking maybe 100 a day.
You should be dead.
I should be dead, yeah.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Ron Free dropped out of sight. He did get married. He moved around. He tried working as a salesman, as a clerk, and a cabbie. For a dozen years or so, he even gave up the thing he loved the most— his drumming.
It was very painful, I'll put it that way, but I was burned out. I'd taken all these speed pills, played 24-hour-a-day jam sessions, and it reached a point where it didn't work anymore. And so I didn't feel like I could ever even play sober. So I almost had to give it all up in order to really get clean.
But you gave it up for a long time.
Well, yeah. didn't even listen to jazz because it was too painful to listen and not be a part of it. So I listened to the Beatles and Rolling Stones and things like that, you know. And for the first time in my life, I listened to music as music and not from the drummer's standpoint. You know, any time I'd listen to records before, I was always in my head, I was drumming. Okay, what would I be doing here, you know, if I was doing this? And
how did you get back into music, Rob?
Well, driving a cab in San Diego. One night I picked up the bartender at Elks Club, and we got to talking on the way to his house, and turns out he was a big jazz fan. And I told him, well, I used to be a jazz drummer. Told him my name and everything. Turns out he had some Mose Allison records that I was on, and so he was all excited about discovering me driving a cab. And he knew a lot of musicians around town, and so he insisted on taking me to a couple of nightclubs to meet some of his musician friends.
Now, what were you thinking about this? You had consciously pushed this music, that life, away for, as you say, 10, 12 years. And here's somebody saying, no, come on back in.
Well, it was scary. But, you know, it had never really died completely. I always missed it. And so anyhow, I wound up sitting in at a couple of places, scared to death of it, like starting all over again, because I didn't know whether, well, geez, does this stuff still apply? or am I a dinosaur? And it must have been all right because I started getting called for gigs.
Ron eventually found a quiet and safe haven playing drums at a resort in Hot Springs, Virginia. But that's not quite where his story ends. The jazz fan I mentioned earlier, Sam Stevenson, had found the tapes of the Eugene Smith Jazz Loft sessions, and he was listening to them. Sam became fascinated with all of Smith's recordings.
He had the place wired from the sidewalk to the fifth floor. And he had mics everywhere, and some of them were somewhat hidden. And he could be in his loft and press play and record at any moment. And depending on what was going on, he would decide whether to do that or not. But they do sound great. It almost sounds like a professional because there's no one instrument blasting above the others. You can hear everything. You can hear the bass.
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is 50 years old now.
Yeah. And there's some professional jazz recordings where you can't hear the bass. And on these, you know, there are most of them, you can hear every instrument and hear it pretty well.
Let's go back to your encounter with Ron Free. You'd figured out that this guy was important, not only to these tapes, but to jazz at that time. How did you find him?
Ron wrote a piece about his life for the Note, a jazz newsletter at East Stroudsburg State University. And I contacted the editor who gave me Ron's contact information. I was sitting there, I remember looking at those numbers and thinking, I wonder what's on the other end of this line.
Yeah, because the last you knew, this guy disappeared from the New York jazz scene, strung out on heroin, right?
Right.
So what happened?
I had heard these incredible things from highly respected musicians about how great he was. And then when I finally found him, it was remarkable how
unassuming yeah.
that he was.
Did he know that these Jazz Loft recordings even existed?
I mean, he had lived there for close to 2 years, I think. And so he knew what Smith was up to, but I don't know if he knew that they'd been saved or anything like that.
What was his reaction?
The first thing I remember him saying is, you know, he sounded like a bull in a china shop. I mean, he was critical of himself.
Huh.
Yeah. I remember one thing he told me, you know, after the dust sort of settled on his first week of listening, you know, it does me some good to realize that this actually happened and that I achieved something worthwhile in that loft. He had thought that it had become kind of a part of his imagination or something, that this had happened 40, 50 years ago. I think that his legacy will be based on these tapes.
Sam Stevenson is now the director of something called the Jazz Loft Project at Duke University. He's working on a 10-part series that will air next year on public radio. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And when I first heard about this story and the rediscovery of the drummer Ron Free,
I was curious to know if he was really as good as his reputation and those old tapes. After all, his regular gig now is playing in a lounge at a resort hotel. But then I heard this cut from a recording of his with the Elmer Gibson Trio that was released just a few years ago.
You should be.
That's a good sound system you got here.
Well, it's good drumming too, isn't it?
Not bad.
No, come on now. You, of all people, can judge drumming. That's good drumming.
Yeah, I must say, it sounded good.
Do you ever feel any regrets, Ron, that there was this world-class drummer in New York in the early 60s who then just sort of put all that away and went off and lived another couple of lives and then came back to it so many years later? Do you feel like you missed something?
You know what? It's all just perfect. I went through years of bemoaning that fate, you know.
Feeling sorry for yourself?
Yeah, because I could have been a contender, you know. But I tell you what, the second time around, it's void of all those downers. You know, a lot of my childhood heroes were junkies and messed up human beings, and then I went that route myself, and, you know, drug addiction is no fun. I mean, it was just horrible. I went through about a 5-year period of clinical depression. I didn't think I would ever feel joy again. But I feel better now than I've ever felt in my life. I'm playing better than I ever have in my life. Because it's minus all those neuroses. I was a neurotic mess. I always thought that, wow, if I could just play with these guys, if I could record with these guys, then I would be somebody. I would, you know, and I would be validated. Didn't work that way. I was the same screwed up, neurotic mess that I was before, only more so.
But the fame and the stature and all that's supposed to compensate for a messed up life, that's no balance.
Doesn't do it. Will not work. I mean, I could probably search around and find some regrets. One that comes to mind, it's just a little small thing, but that great day in Harlem when all the musicians were on
this iconic photograph.
Yeah, right. And Gene Krupa was there. And had I not been so sick and neurotic and messed up at the time, I would have loved to have gone up to him and just say, Gene, when I was 12 years old, man, you let me sit in with your band. I would just like to let him know how much that meant. But as far as the big picture, I'm thankful for all of it. I not only survived, but I've thrived. I mean, life is just wonderful.
I want to ask you one more question. We started this conversation by talking about this sort of wide-eyed fascination of a 6-year-old boy for the sound of the drum. And I wonder where that is with you now. Is that way back in the past, or do you still have some of that fascination with the drum?
Yep. Like the poem says, you know, to this day there's been no greater joy than the sound of the drum. But it's still thrilling to me when it's right.
The jazz drummer Ron Free now has a part-time gig helping identify those musicians who are on the Gene Smith Jazz Loft recordings. Sam Stevenson, as I mentioned earlier, is working in partnership with WNYC Radio in New York on the Jazz Loft Radio Project. It's a public radio series that's being produced in association with the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke and is to be broadcast next year.
You can find out more about the project and more about Ron Free on our website at thestory.org. And heck, if you're ever in Hot Springs, Virginia, drop in at the Homestead. You might catch Ron Free playing there. The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. Rachel McCarthy does a lot of our audio editing. She's sitting in these days as a producer here with us. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of The Story is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.